We got to address the suburban women problem because it's real.
Suburban women helped determine the 2020 election, but there's more to us than the headlines would have you believe.
The suburbs aren't a homogenous sea of white people in perfect houses. Real change is happening in the suburbs, and we have things to say.
When women share their personal stories, walls come down and barriers are broken.
Welcome to the Suburban Women Problem, a podcast from Red, Wine, and Blue.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. I'm Rachel Vindman.
I'm Jasmine Clark.
I'm Amanda Weinstein.
And you're listening to the Suburban Women Problem. Buckle up, everyone, because this week I am sitting down with Sarah Longwell about her podcast, The Focus Group, which is truly a wild ride. But I appreciated our conversation because she talks about listening to people with whom she doesn't necessarily agree in an effort that she can understand what they're thinking and try to change their minds. And I think that's a goal we should all have. And
I love that.
And a nice check for me, actually, on my motivation sometimes. Before that, we're going to chat with Adrienne Elrod, who's a Democratic strategist, in hopes that she can explain a little bit about what's been going on in Washington, because honestly, we're all a little confused, or at least I am. It seems like everything going on the Hill is a jumbled mess, so we want some help breaking it all down. So before we bring Adrienne in, Jasmine and Amanda, can you explain any of this to our listeners, or maybe just to me?
Yeah, so let's talk about the debt ceiling.
Please, yes, thank you.
There's a number of things Congress does regularly that are just used as tools to get what their political party wants, not necessarily what the American people want, and one of those is the debt ceiling. So the debt ceiling is the cap Congress puts on how much federal debt they will allow. So I think of this would be like if you randomly capped your credit card debt to say $500, because that's what you expected to spend in the next month. And then your kid happens to need ear tubes. Or you have a flood in your basement like we did, and insurance doesn't pay for everything. And suddenly now you can't cover the cost of your kid's surgery, or you can't cover the cost of replacing what you need to replace because you weren't expecting to pay above $500. So what the debt ceiling is used for, especially by the Republican Party, is it's used as this like hammer to try and cut all government spending, right? So to be clear, this is about Republicans cutting the spending that they don't like. Spending on childcare, food stamps, unemployment insurance, disability insurance, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. You just keep listing all of it they want to cut. But when we think about where the debt comes from, why do we have debt? Republicans cut taxes. The reason why we don't have the cash is because they are cutting the taxes that would help us build back better and help us create a more sustainable economy and a more sustainable country that works for everyone.
That's very good. I mean, I think that's a great explanation. I took notes. Is this going to be on the test, Professor Weinstein?
It made me understand it a little bit more myself, and I'm in politics, so I loved it. Thank you.
You should maybe do this for everyone. You should make a YouTube video or something. But now I'm going to pivot to Jasmine and say, can you explain the filibuster to us, please?
Stella's like, I'll do it, girl. Watch this.
I will explain the filibuster shortly after this jogger goes by my house. All right, so let's talk filibuster. So the filibuster is this thing that we have right now in Congress that basically stops the ability for us to vote on things. That's the quick and dirty version. It was actually used a lot during the civil rights movement to kind of block civil rights legislation. And so what a lot of times when I think of the filibuster, I think of like someone standing in the well of Congress and just talking and talking and talking for hours.
Salad recipes.
Yes. And they can't leave.
Doesn't have to be related.
They can't go to the restroom. Like they, you know, they just stay there. And it's just to prolong the debate and to keep the debate going. So these controversial or hot button issues that we really do need to have debate and a vote on, they just get stuck and put to the side. Mm-hmm. And right now, Democrats have the majority, but we don't have the ability to pass things in the Senate.
Oh, yeah. I never thought about it. But the filibuster and the debt ceiling are pretty similar, and as listening to the way you described it, because they're both used as tools, mainly by the Republican Party, for Congress not to do their job. In my opinion, their job is to debate. real issues, not salad recipes, right? They should be debating and they should be voting, and they should be determining where government should be spending, how it should be spending, how it should not be spending, what tax levels are, and the debt ceiling and the filibuster prevent them from doing their job. And other countries don't have it. It doesn't have to be this way, but we have it, so we think it's normal.
One of the things I think is interesting about it is it's really hard to get Republicans to vote with us. They're just constantly in lockstep. And I, you know, the Democratic Party is a coalition. It's not a unified party. It's not a party that has the same like key issues, much like the three of us. We don't agree on every issue. But right now, the fight is not about how much debt should we have. Should we have bigger government or smaller government? Right now, we have to be united in fighting against the Republicans, because it's not the old Republican Party. Sarah Longwell and I talked about that. This is a new Republican Party. It's completely different, and we have to fight it at all costs. It's great to have different opinions, but right now we have to unite and fight. That's it.
Oh, trust me, the frustration that I feel as a Democrat right now, and the frustration that I hear from my constituents that are just like, what is going on in Washington, D.C.? You know, right now, it seems like Democrats are on the same page about things and that we should all be working toward the same goals. But we do have a few Dems on our side that have decided to kind of go their own way, or some might even describe it as going rogue. But I think it speaks to the larger point of the Democratic Party being very inclusive. We are the big tent party. We let everybody in. And not only do we let you in, but we let you express yourself and be yourself and have your opinions and do what you want to do. And while that is amazing, I love being a part of a party that is inclusive. I love being a part of a party that is diverse. I love being a part of a party that doesn't tell you how to think. At the same time, that strength of our party can sometimes feel like a weakness, because we finally are in the majority. And if we don't get things passed, then we're not going to hold on to that majority. It's like,
it's so basic.
We have to be better at playing chess. And right now, it doesn't feel like we're playing chess very well at all. Like, at all.
I'm a big Yellowstone fan, and I love to bring out my inner Beth Dutton when I need to. And she is a fighter, to put it mildly. And, I mean, even as a teenager, I signed up for the military because I was ready to fight. When something is right, you fight for it. Like, this is just in my bones. So I don't understand why Democrats aren't fighting hard for all of these really, really important things that we need.
Yeah.
The Republican Party has no problem throwing punches. I'm ready to throw some punches. And I'm ready to throw some punches to get paid leave, to get childcare for all of our kids, to make sure that we all have health care. I am ready to fight. And I just don't understand why these things that are not very left, because every other country has paid leave except for us and like Papua New Guinea. Like, this is not far left, right? Why can't we throw these punches and get this stuff done?
I completely agree with you. It's extremely frustrating to me. There simply will not be a next time. There will not be another 2 years after the midterms if we don't win right now.
And I think we need to realize who's in our tent, right? It's a lot of women. And it's a lot of women, I think, who are ready to fight. And we're ready to fight for paid leave and childcare. So let's fight.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like, these things have been popular and they've pulled well with suburban women, even if they have a history of coming from a more conservative side. Because what we care about is what affects our family, what affects us and our family, and what is happening in Washington that's going to impact us. So let's talk to Adrian Elrod, who can hopefully help us understand it. Adrian is a political strategist with over 22 years of experience, bless her heart, including on the Hillary Clinton campaign. Adrian, welcome to the Suburban Women Problem.
Hi, Rachel. Thank you so much for having me. I'm a huge fan of this podcast, and I'm honored to be on as a guest.
We are so excited to have you here because there is so much going on inside the Beltway right now, and we have a lot of questions. So let's start with this Dems in disarray narrative. We were just talking about how two of us, Amanda and I, are former Republicans, and we're used to throwing punches and sticking to the party line. From our point of view, it feels like the Democrats aren't fighting as hard as they could be. What's your perspective on that?
I mean, you know, I kind of agree with you, and that does seem to sort of be the narrative that's starting to take shape. But, you know, I think what's important, at least, you know, from my perspective as a lifelong Democrat, is to look at the fact that we are so united on so many things right now. And, you know, unfortunately, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema are sucking up so much of the oxygen because they're the two people who are, you know, in slight disagreement when it comes to some of the policies that are moving forward through Congress. But overall, Democrats are mostly unified, and that's what, you know, that's what matters the most. But I do think that we could see a little bit more energy coming from our side. I thought Chuck Schumer's speech last night on Republicans' initial refusal to raise the debt ceiling was very effective. I'd love to see more of that. He managed to really upset, I think, a lot of us Republican colleagues, and that's the kind of fire that we need to fight back with. So I was happy to see that, and I hope to see more of that.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. So can you tell us a little bit about the infrastructure bill? So what's going on, you know, and what is in there? What is it going to give American families?
The infrastructure bill, what we're calling the Biden infrastructure bill, which is short for BIF, B-I-F is what sort of the nickname is hard infrastructure. So that is roads, highways, bridges, versus the reconciliation bill, which is really the Build Back Better agenda. It's essentially the budget, right? And what is included in that is, you know, more of the like soft social net programs. Some people call it soft infrastructure. And again, that goes back to expanded childcare access, lowering the cost of prescription drugs through Medicare, paid leave, so that we actually have a federal paid leave policy. And I think in particular, that issue has taken on stronger resonance over the course of the last year and a half because a lot of people have had to take off work to take care of sick parents from COVID or sick family members. I think paid leave is something that, you know, hopefully will not get cut from this bill. But that's sort of what the reconciliation bill is, right? So it's just the safety net, social safety net programs that are not tangible, but are an important part of the fabric of our country. And, you know, it's a really important thing for President Biden to be able to say that he delivered on these promises that he ran on during the campaign. And a lot of those promises are contained in that bill.
Yeah. So as a mom with kids, when I was hearing you describe, you know, driving on roads, like we need roads to get to work. And in the back of my mind, I was like, do you know what else I need to get to work? I need my kids to be in daycare. Because when I don't have childcare, I cannot get to work. And guess what? I can drive to work on a bumpy road, but I cannot get to work without childcare. And so when I hear infrastructure, I hear that kind of, I think you call it soft infrastructure. I totally think that's just as important. And in some cases now we're realizing it might actually be more important to a lot of people out there. So does that make me in like the more progressive wing?
Probably.
But I
also think it just makes you like, you know,
a woman,
an American working mom, right, who wants greater childcare. I mean, you know, look, if we're going to get anything done after reconciliation, if we're going to get voting rights passed, if we're going to get the crime bill passed, if we're going to address police reform, we're going to have to do something to revise the filibuster. Because right now, things are just simply not getting done. Biden's got, you know, 2 years, guaranteed 2 years to be able to get some of this stuff done before, you know, we'll see what happens in the 2022 midterms. But he's got a guaranteed 2 years of full Democratic control, and the time to get these things done is now. And if he can't get his agenda passed with the filibuster, then I think he's going to have to really seriously consider how much pressure he's willing to put on Chuck Schumer and others in the, you know, in the Senate to revise that process.
Oh, my inner Beth Dutton from Yellowstone says, get rid of that filibuster.
Me too.
And here, but same. Here's why. I understand the hesitancy because I understand that if we lose power, Republican, that then it is an advantage for Republican Party. But here's my sense of the Republican Party. This is not the party of ideas and policy. They're the party of no. And also, they're the party of policies that don't poll well with the American people. So if they do get power and then they start passing all these policies that Americans hate, that actually, I think, is okay because then we can see what their party is all about and it's not the American people and what most Americans want. So if they get power and pass really bad policies, I think we need to see that as Americans.
So what issues should we be talking, what other issues, I guess, besides this, are something that we should be talking to, you know, our fellow moms, things that are happening in Washington that affect real people and outside of the Beltway?
Well, look, I know we touched on paid leave. That is something that is an issue that is near and dear to my heart. And it's absolutely beyond frustrating for not just, you know, me personally, but I think so many women and men across this country that we don't have a federal paid leave policy. One other thing that I want to bring up is the child tax credit.
Yes.
Yes. I was just thinking that when you were saying it.
Oh my gosh. That was on my mind too.
Yeah. Yeah, the child tax credit, it's so incredible. I actually worked for the National Economic Security Project earlier this year on a public awareness campaign to try to just raise awareness of what the CTC, what the child tax credit is. It's basically the average person, the average parent, receives up to $300 a month per child. There was an ad that we did at the Economic Security Project on this at the very beginning where, you know, sort of like a man on the street, somebody went around to a bunch of parents just walking down the street and said, what would you do if you had $300 more in your pocket a month for your families? One woman said, oh man, I'd send my kid to soccer camp. Another woman said, you know, I'd buy fresh blueberries instead of frozen blueberries. You know, and then, you know, of course somebody said, you know, well, we would save up the money and take a family vacation that we haven't done in 5 years. You know, those are the things that the child tax credit, it not only lifts kids out of poverty, but it also helps middle-class parents who literally do not have an extra dime in their budget to spend on anything that's not necessary, actually provide a little bit more of a fun life for their family and for their kids.
You know, Adrienne, thank you so much for joining us. I just want to, as we wrap up, I want to say to our listeners, if these are things that are important to you, if you've learned something here that you are really for and want to promote, I urge you to call your elected officials. The other side, we allow them to be the loudest voice in the room because they're screaming and throwing tantrums. But we need to also call with support, not just with complaints. And it's so, so important for our elected officials to have those phone calls and have that documented. Even if you're just leaving a voicemail, it is very important. But Adrienne, thank you so much for joining us and for breaking this stuff down for us and explaining it. It's so complicated and you've made it very simple. So we really appreciate your time with us today.
Well, thank you, ladies. And congratulations again on such a successful podcast. I listen a lot. And I always come away from it learning quite a bit. So thank you all so much for having me. It was an honor.
If you would like more information on how to contact your elected officials, it will be in the show notes. And I really encourage you to do that. After the break, I'll be joined by Sarah Longwell to talk about the everyday American voters she's talking to in her focus groups, from hardcore MAGA people to swing voters who were turned off by Trump. Stick around for that interview after the break.
Do you feel like you could use some support figuring out how to respond to anti-mask, anti-vax, or anti-CRT messaging in your community? We invite you to sign up for one of our Troublemaker trainings. They're fun events where you can meet other women who are facing this stuff too, and learn strategies to stand up for the kids in your community. Our next training will be on Thursday, October 14th at 8 p.m. Eastern. You can sign up and find more information at mobilize.us/redwineblueusa or at the link in show notes.
Our guest today is a political strategist and a publisher of the website The Bulwark. She is the founder of Republican Voters Against Trump, and she has a new podcast called The Focus Group, where she listens to regular Americans in focus groups talk about politics. It's a little bit scary, but it's definitely worth listening to. I highly recommend it. Sarah, welcome to the Suburban Women Problem.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. It's nice to see you in person. We've only ever talked on Twitter.
I know, you as well. And, you know, we both live in the same area, but, you know, enter COVID.
Oh, we should hang out sometime.
And, yeah, we should. So your podcast is a little disarming at times. It catches you a little off guard what people say, because it might be like they're saying normal things and sounding normal, and then you just kind of fall off a cliff. You do this for a living, so does it not surprise you anymore?
You know, I guess it doesn't surprise me at this point. You know, when I started the focus groups, it was in 2018, and I'll tell you what I was caught off guard by. I was caught off guard by Donald Trump getting elected president. And the reason I started doing the focus groups is that I, as somebody who had been a Republican her whole life, been active in Republican politics and organizations and policy, I was like, man, what did I miss? What don't I understand about what's going on? Because clearly something.
Sure. Yeah.
But the thing is that there's a symbiotic relationship between Trump, right-wing sort of infotainment media, and the voters. And so they're all impacting each other in this way that has slowly over time really changed voters. And so especially, I mean, the voters that comprise the Republican Party. And the more I listened to voters, the more I realized that Trump had seen something that I definitely had not about the party, which was they were much less interested in the things that had sort of brought me to conservatism. They were not, you know, despite the Tea Party, it was not things like the debt or limiting government. It was much more about culture and immigration, a set of grievances. And so I now, having done so many of them, and I'll tell you, I do different types of groups. Going into 2020, I spent most of my time on potentially persuadable voters. So swing voters, people who rated Donald Trump as somewhat bad or very bad. Mm-hmm. I've been doing a lot with just pure Trump voters lately because I've also been trying to think about how do you pull people out of some of this? You know, everything that I do in my work is about persuasion. And so the reason that I feel like it's so necessary to listen to people is that you just, unless you know what you're up against, unless you know what information people are consuming, it becomes very difficult to think about how you might persuade someone and also to be able to bucket people into who should you be trying to persuade and who should you just say, don't bother. You're not getting to this person.
Right. Yeah. It's an economy of, you know, time and energy, and there's no use wasting it on people that can't be, you know, talked to. But I think a lot of our listeners, you know, want to engage in conversations with people and friends who maybe have casually heard some of these things and, you know, try to offer a counter that's, you know, not militant, but just, you know, push back and say, well, actually, that's not true. And I thought your last episode discussing, it was the Pure MAGA group, the third episode. I don't know if that's the most recent, but the most recent one I listened to. And it was just Pure MAGA groups. Mm-hmm. What I heard a lot of them saying was that they longed for a time that is no more. Change has been very hard. Change is actually also very hard for me, so I can relate to this in some way. I also understand it's inevitable, but it's still hard. And I heard a lot of that in what they were saying. Do you find that to be a common thread, even with the people who are hesitant about Trump? But do they see too much change too quickly in our country?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you're right. In the latest focus group, and I hear this all the time, you know, I always open up with sort of the same question. How do you think things are going in the country? And
mm-hmm. I love that question.
Yeah. And in the groups, I think especially these days in the sort of double Trump voting group, 16 and 20, you hear a lot of catastrophizing, you know, this, and they say things like, I don't even know if I can have kids and leave this country to them. And actually somebody talked about this in the most recent focus group episode where they were like, you know, online, everybody's so mad and they're so angry. And then you go outside and you talk to your neighbors and it's pretty normal.
And I loved that. Yes. Yes. I loved that. That's something that Alex said a lot. My husband said a lot during his book tour. And I think it's really true. Like, look around. Is everything on fire? No, stop. I mean, but this is amazingly effective. I don't understand. We buy into it even though we don't see evidence of it.
And I do think that the way that our information stream works, it creates this sense of urgency. And politics is about creating a sense of urgency, right? You want to turn people out. You're creating wedge issues. And so the divisiveness, and everybody recognizes it. Like, they're humans who say, I don't know, we're awfully divided and I don't like it. But then, like, 5 minutes later, they're like, you know who I hate? And, you know? And I think some of that's just, you know, some of that's just human. But I will say this, like, I like a lot of these people. Like, they say things oftentimes that I think are wrong and bad. But I still, their humanity is clear in a lot of them. And for many of them, they're kind of operating with the information that they have. And so one of the things that when people are like, how can you listen to these people like spew this misinformation and this crazy talk? And I'm like, you know who I hold responsible? Like, the section of the focus groups that I do where I ask people what media they consume tells you everything.
Yes.
And there are people out there who agitate on purpose. They pour poison into people's brains. And look, these people have agency. They are responsible for their own choices. They're responsible for how they live their lives. But there are actors and forces that are converging on these voters whose information is limited. Like, they don't sit and talk about politics the way that we do. They're not like following every DOJ report that comes out or whatever. Like, it's just not how they live their lives. And so for me, it is more about trying to understand how they get their information and what information would be persuasive to them to kind of get them to, you know, operate in a way that I think is less destructive.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love that. I think it's really important. You're right. People are operating with the information they have, and that's solely dependent upon where they receive their information. When you listen to these focus groups, what is the most surprising thing, you know, sort of consistently surprising thing that you hear?
I mean, I think when people start to tell you about how QAnon really does make some sense, and if you just, you know, looked at, you know, well, if you just looked at what was going on in Hollywood, you would see that there is a pedophile ring, or when they can somehow trace the election being stolen back to Hillary Clinton's server. And I've never been quite sure if the pandemic didn't make people 20% sort of crazier in general, because there's just so much paranoia out there. And so, I mean, it really, it's the conspiracy stuff. It's, and I'll, the thing that I always want to say, it makes me laugh, but like, you know, you're about to hear something wild when someone says, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but, and you're like, okay.
Yeah, that's, I can imagine. So we've talked a little bit about the pure MAGA voters, but going back on your first two episodes, you know, you talked to some swing voters, people who identified as Republican, like me, like you, but they were definitely off put by Trump. What have you heard in your focus groups about what would keep those swing voters from going back to the GOP?
Yeah, it's a great question. And here's my theory right now of how politics could converge to push either those kind of disaffected Republican voters whom Trump repelled firmly into kind of a either future former Republican, they're either future former Republicans or they maybe they're going to be red dog Democrats where they kind of make up a more conservative wing of the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. I think for that to happen, people have to get over something that I call the Reagan hangover, which is that there's a lot of these voters that are kind of moderate who don't follow politics super closely, and they kind of still think maybe Paul Ryan or John Kasich's going to come back and save them or like take over the party. Mm-hmm. And they haven't realized yet how firm Trump's grip on this party is and how many of the candidates that are coming up in 2022 are just made in Trump's image. And so I think the thing that would sort of solidify them as kind of red dog Democrats would be for there to be really good narrative setting. And I think, you know, Republicans are better at defining Democrats by their most extreme people than Democrats are at defining Republicans. Democrats don't spend as much time defining because they have, like, I think more affirmative policy things they want to get done. So they just don't spend as much time on just messaging how bad the other side is. Mm-hmm. But I think as we start to see Herschel Walker and Josh Mandel and Kari Lake in Arizona, and there's this litmus test going on. I mean, if you look at the people who Trump is endorsing, they are all people who are spouting his election lies, who say that they might not certify in 2024. Like, it's become this litmus test to get his endorsement is you gotta be an election truther. And so I do think that Eric Greitens, if he picks up Trump's nomination in Missouri, that guy had to resign for tying up a woman in his basement and like photographing and blackmailing her. He scammed a veterans charity. Like, if these are the people that emerge in 22, I do think then it might start to dawn on people mm-hmm. that this is Trump's party and that there's a bunch of really Trumpy candidates. Because if you look at 2020, right, Trump lost, but a bunch of Republicans down ticket did okay and
right.
did well.
Yes,
because
yes.
a bunch mm-hmm. of people who were like normie Republicans said, well, I'm going to vote for my regular Republican congressman. I still feel like a Republican. They're not Trump. I just hate Trump. Trump will repel those voters if he's on the ballot. But Democrats have to put him on the ballot and they have to help build this narrative about the Republican Party becoming too extreme to govern. Trump's going to help them with that by putting forward a bunch of candidates who are, in fact, mm-hmm. too extreme to govern.
Yeah. Oh, that's very interesting. We talk a lot on our show about how Trump spurred so many women into political action, including myself. And there are also a lot of Trump supporters who were activated too. That's the thing. People who had never been involved in politics. We believe our activism will continue, you know, long after Trump's defeat. It has to, if there's going to be any meaningful change. But do you worry that even without Trump, that the MAGA activism will continue?
Yes, I have no doubt about it. Although this idea of like without Trump to me is what is without Trump? I mean, first of all, I'll just throw out there that I firmly believe this is a guy who's going to run again in 2024. And I also believe that even if he doesn't, we should operate as though he is, because it's such a clear and present threat to democracy. I mean, the pressure this guy applied on the institutions of our democracy to bend them to his will is just catastrophic, and a second term, I think, would be terrible for the country. But I do think there is the upside of Trump was that because he was so brazen about what he thought, there's no winking and nodding, and it allowed a bunch of people to see clearly who he was and who a lot of politicians were willing to follow. I mean, I'm glad to know sooner rather than later, yes, who those people are, because mm-hmm, we know now they have been mm-hmm weighed mm-hmm and measured and yes, found wanting, yes, morally. They do not have spines. They should not lead a country. And I think they brought out this whole political coalition, including tons of these suburban women. And I think the reason that they were so activated is because they were not going to just accommodate the naked racism, the naked sexism, the number of sexual assaulters or physical assaulters surrounded that Trump himself, but also that surrounded Donald Trump is unbelievable. And
definitely
to live in a country that accommodates that and to be in a political party that champions Trump and all the people around him, that I think is what motivates the, because it's like deep in your gut, you're like, this is, you just know it's wrong. You can have policy fights all day long, but for me, and I'm still decently conservative about a number of issues, but what's happening right now is wrong, and it's like easy to see.
It's so hard, I think, for people to hear. I mean, it must be hard, I guess, for you, but for listeners to hear people say things that are just completely untrue. I mean, they are alternative facts. It's an alternative reality. How do you stay quiet in your focus groups? I think it's because you respect people and want to hear what they have to say. But what advice would you give someone who's listening to someone in like more of a friend setting or a social setting to push back and to try to offer something different? Or,
oh yeah. I mean, and the thing, yes, you should definitely push back against misinformation. But people, you know, say like, well, how can you just sit there and listen to people say things that are patently untrue? And I think the reason is it's actually not even out of a respect or liking people. I mean, those things are true, but that's not why. The reason is that I want to persuade people. Mm-hmm. That is my ultimate goal. It's the work that I do is how do you persuade audiences to get outcomes that I think are better for the country and for democracy? Well, to do that, I need to understand how people go through the motions of arriving at the conclusions that they do and what information it is that they have and how they're processing it. And so in the room, what I want to know is I just want to know what they think. I want to know how they got there. I want to know what they saw that gave them that information. And sometimes I'll push back, like when somebody says, well, Dominion changed all the votes. And you'll say, okay, but where did you see that they did that? And I'm not going to push back and be like, you're wrong about that. I'm going to push back and say, you know, I don't know if that's true, because, you know, where would you have gotten that information? Because I want to know where they got that information, because I'm trying to build bigger persuasion programs. And so I basically have to suck it up. Not suck it up, but like I want to hear what 10 people have to say so I understand how I can persuade 10,000. And that's the ultimate goal.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great answer. I mean, I think that's a great lesson for all of us, you know, is to ask those probing questions. Thank you so much. And now we're going to jump into our rapid fire questions, which may or may not be easier. But are you ready?
I'm ready. Hit me.
Okay. Now, the first question is a little bit selfish because I need to change my life a little bit and we live in the same area. So what is your favorite place to go with your wife on a date night?
Oh, you're looking for like nice restaurant recommendations. And unfortunately, I'm going to get my favorite place to go with my wife is actually this place called Annie's Paramount Steakhouse, which is kind of a hole in the wall in DuPont that was like around the corner from our first little starter home and where we got engaged. And it's just has the best Bloody Marys.
Okay. What is your favorite TV show from childhood?
Probably Saved by the Bell. That was like my generation. I really grew up with Zach Morris with the big cell phone.
My dad had a theory that Saved by the Bell only had like 5 episodes and they just...
Oh my God, no, they like went through college. I followed those people the whole way up.
Yeah, I'm like, it just is the same plot basically every day, but it is different, actually different episodes. They're wearing different clothes. It's obvious. Mm. If you could travel back in time to any historical period for one day, what would it be?
You know, I should probably do humanity a bigger favor and say that, like, I would go back and, you know, do something about Hitler or something. But honestly, the thing that I think about the most is I wish that on January 7th of this year, mm-hmm. that I had, you know, there was this period where you thought, okay, this finishes him, you know? And I was kind of like, I don't know, I haven't seen anything to break the fever yet. And I wish that I had just had the foresight to be running around saying, this isn't going to break him. And everybody needs to push right now to hold them accountable, because otherwise you're going to find yourselves exactly where we are now. We're 6 months. They've retconned this thing into being no big deal. And so that's the thing that keeps me up at night, where I'm like, I wish I could go back and make every donor, every media person, everyone understand that this isn't just going to solve itself.
Wow. That's, yes. What is your favorite reaction GIF?
It's the Michael Scott one where he says, why are you the way that you are? When he says that to Toby, because that's all I ever want to know from people. Why are you like this?
Oh, I love it. You have a few podcasts at this point, but if you could co-host another pod with anyone in the world, who would you choose?
Yeah, again, I should probably say like Gandhi or something, but honestly, the podcast I really want to do is with my sister. I've got this sister who is a, you know, actress in LA, who is the funniest person on the planet. And she's just the best. And because she has like a Frasier podcast.
Nice.
She does more, you know, someday I would like to do something with her. I just don't know what we do it about. I just want to talk to her more, you know? Yeah, you never just want to like hang out with somebody.
You could just try that, just talking and doing a podcast. Why not?
I could. There's plenty. I only talk to people in podcasts now. It's always with a microphone.
So, all right. That is the end of our rapid fire questions. I really do want to suggest, though, that you just do a talking podcast with your sister, because I think many people would tune in. But since that is not happening yet, where can listeners go to listen to you?
Yeah, the main thing, so my new podcast is called The Focus Group. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. And then there's also, I do a lot, I'm the publisher of The Bulwark. Most of my podcasts are under The Bulwark. Right. So I have the French Village podcast, mm-hmm. if you've ever watched that show.
Yes, of course. I've actually not watched the show, but I love listening to you and Ben. So
you listen to a lot of, where do you get time to listen to all these podcasts? It's amazing.
I do it all, I have my ear pods in and I'm all, and my family talks to me and I just kind of nod and I pretend like I'm listening, but I'm not. I'm never listening. So because when they're not, they don't have ear pods in, they're also not listening to me. So I feel like it's justified. I don't feel guilty about this in any way. Thank you so much for joining us on the Suburban Women Problem. It's my pleasure to interview you and just to hear your great insight. I think you've offered a lot to all of our listeners. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was so much fun.
Welcome back, everybody. So, Rachel, I really enjoyed listening to your interview with Sarah. And I think I enjoyed it a lot because it was kind of like looking in a mirror, but like, you know, someone kind of describing my party, the party that I've been affiliated with pretty much my entire life, and, you know, describing both our strengths and our weaknesses. So it was really a really interesting conversation for me to listen to as a person who has basically been a lifelong Democrat.
It's interesting to see your side through other people's lens, you know, to see,
yeah, exactly.
To see how they're perceiving you, because perception is reality and it's hard sometimes. That's a difficult process, but it is a necessary process if we are going to ever come together.
Oh, yeah. I tell my students it is so important to understand both sides of anything, even if you just want to get your own way, right? Even if our own self-interest, right? If I want paid leave, right? I need to understand what the people against paid leave are going to say. If they're going to say this is too expensive, great. Let me show you the economics behind why this works for our economy and why it works for every other industrialized nation out there, right? And then I know what is the most effective argument. So I absolutely love this approach. All right. So I think it is time for our toast to joy. We are the party of the glasses half full, so we need to end on our toast of joy. Jasmine, what is your toast to joy today?
My toast to joy this week is actually planning my birthday. So my birthday is actually not until December, but this is going to be my last birthday in my 30s. And so I was like, oh, well, what do I want to do? And I was really wavering and like, oh, I don't know. So I've planned my birthday. I'm going to do a little short vacation with myself so far. Other people are invited if they want to show up. So let me know if y'all feel like going to the Caribbean in
yes.
December. But I am like doing it and I'm not going to talk myself out of it. And I'm going to make this thing happen. So I'm really excited just about like being a little bit more intentional about things. So that's my toast to joy, is to being intentional.
Oh, that sounds amazing. I've been doing the same thing, partly because my therapist told me to. And people used to say, be intentional. And I'm like, fine, my intention is to wake up and kick ass today. And that's what I'm going to do. But I did not quite understand what intentional meant until I heard other people were like, oh, I'm actually going to like schedule this to make sure that I do these things. That is your intention. I was like, oh, yeah, don't do that.
Exactly.
So my toast to joy today, especially I love that we're talking to Sarah Longwell and how she is talking to a lot of different people about their different perspectives. So my toast to joy today is actually about my brother who is here visiting Ohio with his family. And we have different perspectives on politics. And he is one person that we can always debate politics. I don't think we've ever gotten mad at each other that I know of. And we can talk politics. So my sister-in-law hates when we do it. But we still do it anyway, and I do love to talk politics with him, and I probably don't do it enough, but I do love that he's here visiting, and I love that he is a person that I can always talk policy and politics with, even though we tend to come at it from different sides.
Yeah, I think that somehow it's easier to have those disagreements with people that we know and love, because we know they're not coming from a place of hatred. And I attended a school board meeting this past week and I didn't speak. I was just attending. And I have to say, like, I didn't like the disrespect. That bothered me. I felt like there were a lot of people that were disrespectful. But there was another thing that I noticed is a lot of the people were, they were like physically scared. They were physically, I mean, they were shaking. There was so much emotion. And it, I think, all comes from a genuine place of fear. Mostly. They feel very right, even though their information is wrong. And we have to balance that, you know, in the real world. And it is hard. I think I've said it like 8 times today, but it's really hard to do, but it is important to listen. And my toast to joy this week is totally different. I'm not planning any trips that are fun, and I'm not really being intentional, but I'm just glad that it's not as humid here. I was in Miami last week and it was so hot. And I was like, why did we leave someplace where it was like kind of just getting over the humidity to go somewhere where it's still super crazy humid? So now we've had some time back at home and it's so nice. This is like what I live for. Virginia is great in the fall. For sure. All the colors and the weather. And it's just a great time of year. But I'm so thankful to be over those really gross, hot, sticky days. So it's not very profound, but I'm really excited about it.
Jasmine, I don't know how you do it.
Oh my gosh. And like, I have bought boots and sweaters. And I'm like, when will I be able to wear these?
Talk about being intentional.
Yeah. I'm like,
and optimistic.
I'm like, I want to wear these boots that I have purchased because they are cute. And I have a cute sweater that goes with it. But it is still 90 degrees. So
well, hang in there. Thank you, everyone, so much for joining us today. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please share it with someone you know. Next week, Jasmine will be talking to author Melinda Winner Moyer about her book, How to Raise Kids Who Aren't Assholes. So please be sure to tune in for that. I know I can't wait.
Can't wait.
We will see you then on another episode of The Suburban Women Problem.
The Suburban Women Problem was created by Red, Wine, and Blue. Our executive producer is Beverly Batt. Our producer and editor is Amy Thorstenson, and our video producer is Ashley Hufford. If you're ready to be part of the Suburban Women Problem, head over to redwine.blue and sign up for our newsletter so you don't miss a thing.